Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Josh Oren, hosting today's show together with Paul Wearson.
Well, hello, Josh, and today we'll be talking about dinosaur genomes. We're going to have an interview with Kay Berger on her new book about a person with 110 personalities. Yeah, you heard that right, 110. And then we'll talk with Casey Johnson, owner of the Ames Ford Lincoln dealership, about his program called Wheels for Work.
And it is Wednesday, and that means we get the news with Dennis Hart. The mic is yours, Dennis.
Josh, thank you. Gosh, I don't even have one personality, much less 110. Let's start this morning with the Nevada Journal, which reports that the Nevada man, accused of smothering his infant daughter with a pillow last January, has pleaded guilty to causing her death. 30-year-old Calvin Curtis White pleaded guilty to child endangerment resulting in death. He will be sentenced July 23rd, and he faces up to 50 years in prison. Also in the journal, a warning from Story County Public Health. With summer officially starting tomorrow, we know that we're going to have numerous heat waves here in Iowa. So the public health folks have some common sense advice they're reminding us about, including such things as drinking more water even if you're not thirsty. Sounds strange, but that's what they say. If you're sweating a lot, replace salt and minerals by eating bananas and salty crackers. Wear sunscreen and wear light-colored, loose-fitting clothing. Wear hats to shade your face and never, ever leave children or pets in a parked car, not even for a minute. Another note about water. The Journal has a feature story this week about the challenges one Nevada woman faced during those tremendous thunderstorms last Thursday. Water started flooding the basement of Leora Dara Jarnigan's home on G Avenue in Nevada. Now, her husband was still at work, so she had to go to a nearby hardware store twice to buy two separate sump pumps. That's how much water was in the basement. She had other problems, but she survived them all, and you can read all about it in this week's Journal. Also in the Journal, a feature story about a Nevada couple who will be rolling around the streets in Nevada this summer in a tiny three-wheeled green pickup truck with polka dots on its body. A freezer is mounted on the back, and yes, it is an ice cream truck. Chad and Jennifer Anderson call it pint-sized ice cream, and if you're in Nevada, you'll likely see it on a street near you this summer. I hope I do. And one more note from the Journal, a reminder about the upcoming 4th of July parade in Nevada. It's going to start at 10 o'clock a.m. on the 4th on E Avenue between 8th and 11th Streets. And yes, the Andersons say their tiny ice cream polka-dotted truck will be there. In the Boone News Republican, word that a firefighter was hospitalized yesterday afternoon after fighting a house blaze in Boone. He was suffering from heat conditions and taken to a hospital as a precaution. He was not immediately identified. The blaze caused at least $50,000 damage to the home at 127 South Story Street. No one was home at the time. Cause of the fire not determined yet. Also in the News Republican, a report on last Thursday's thunderstorms, which dropped anywhere, as you know, from 4.5 to 6.5 inches of rain around these parts. Now, Boone experienced a significant amount of flooding. Many roads were closed. Many of the gravel roads in particular suffered a lot of damage. There's also a long feature story about Diana Starr Helmer in the Boone News Republican. She's getting ready to perform her one-woman show called I Like Mamie, about Boone native Mamie Eisenhower, the wife of President Dwight Eisenhower. Helmer's show imagines what a campaign stop in Boone in 1956 would have been like for her. The play will also cover Mamie's life before 1956, focusing on events such as meeting her future husband, the future president, and their early marriage while he served in the war. Now, opening night for her show is going to be Friday, June 29th, 7 o'clock, at the Boone Community Theater. Additional performances will take place at 7 o'clock on June 30th and 2 o'clock on July 1st. In the Story City Herald, which is out this afternoon, a report that hail falling from our recent thunder boomers has damaged hundreds of homes in the area. The owner of one insurance company says he's received about 125 claims for hail damage, mostly to homes, with the estimated cost for each incident between $8,000 and $12,000. And the owner of Waddle Exteriors in Story City says his company has received hundreds, that's his word, hundreds of calls to inspect homes for hail damage in Story City, Nevada, Huxley, and in other cities. Lots of damage and maybe more this week coming. In the Tri-County Times, word that some streets in Kelly are still flooded nearly a week after last Thursday's big thunderstorms, probably because of a storm water drain clog. And the worry is more rain this week could cause even bigger problems. Also in the Times, council members in Huxley said they were not aware of a recent investigation into possible misuse of money by Huxley Fire and Rescue. That investigation was requested by Fire Chief Chad Anthony, and it discovered more than $5,000 of improper and unsupported disbursements between 2012 and 2017. And finally, there's a report on acting Iowa Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg's appearance in Huxley last Thursday, where he said he agreed with Governor Kim Reynolds' sentiment that the issue of same-sex marriage has been legally settled. Gregg, who is, of course, a Republican, said the GOP should be, in his words, a big tent party. And there it is, guys, your summary of news from the pages of the Nevada Journal, the Boone News Republican, the Story City Herald, and the Tri-County Times right up to the moment. I'm Dennis Hart, and I'm going to be back here live on Friday with a look at this week's news from the pages of the Ames Trib.
Well, thank you, my friend Dennis. Now, KHOI intern Marie McCarthy sat down with Nicole Valenzuela, a professor in ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State, who recently did a study on turtles, birds, and their relation to dinosaurs. Marie talks to us now with Nicole Valenzuela on that matter.
Today we're joined in the studio by Nicole Valenzuela, who was involved in a really interesting study on dinosaur genomics. Nicole, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you for having me. I am a full professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology at Iowa State University.
All right. So what exactly was this study about?
So it was a study trying to look at the comparing turtles and birds, the genomics, so the sort of full set of the DNA content in a organism, trying to do a comparison to figure out what the ancestor of those two lineages might have looked like. And in doing so, then the study is able to shed some light into what dinosaurs, who are close relatives of birds, might have had as a karyotype, as the organization of that genome.
Mm-hmm. So for our listeners who might not know, what exactly is genomics? Because I honestly hadn't really heard of it until I started researching for this story.
Mm-hmm. So genomics is sort of like full-scale genetics. Like instead of looking at one single gene at a time or a few genes at a time, you're trying to look at the whole complement of the gene content in organisms or in species. Mm-hmm. And people who do genomics might be interested in either how what's the content of the full genome or how it works, how it functions, how it's structured, what's the physical organization of it, and that's part of what the study looked at, how it evolves, how it's expressed. And so genomicists look at the whole genome instead of just little bits of it.
All right, thank you. And out of curiosity, how did you get involved in the field or how did you get interested?
So I started being interested in genomics because I was doing work on the evolution of sex determination in turtles. And in looking at that, one issue was how the genome responds to the environment, particularly to temperature during embryonic development, to turn an embryo, turtle, into male or a female, because many turtles have temperature-dependent sex determination. Mm-hmm. But there are other turtles that have sex chromosomes, either XY like humans or ZW sex chromosomes like birds. And that got me interested, both of those things, trying to understand how the genome responds to temperature in the species that have temperature-dependent sex determination, or why the genome is insensitive in those that have sex chromosomes in with regards to producing males or females. And from that, it sort of turned into an interest into the organization of the structure of the genomes of turtles because they differ in the number of chromosomes that they have, which implies that there has been large-scale changes, either fusion of chromosomes or split of chromosomes to increase or decrease their number.
Mm-hmm. Well, as somebody who's not in any field really related to this mm-hmm. kind of stuff, this honestly seems sort of like a science fiction idea. I'm sure you get a lot of that because this seems like a really advanced field and it seems kind of far out there. So how did the idea of reconstructing the genome of an extinct species come about?
So this, what one does there is sort of use the principles of evolutionary biology, one of which is that what we see today, there's species that live today descend from common ancestors, right? Sort of like tree thinking, that we are all connected one way or another to common ancestry. Sort of like genealogy in your family, you're connected to your siblings, to your parents and grandparents. In the same way, species are connected to other species that are more closely related and to more distant branches of species with which we still share some common ancestry, but farther back in time. So mm-hmm. because of that idea, that means that there are traits that if you find that are common to many species that exist today, and they are closely related species, then you may say that one explanation is that they inherited those traits from a common ancestor. Just like if you have you or your siblings all share curly hair or blue eyes, you may have those traits because you inherited those from your parents. So the same idea is sort of looking at the genealogy of species, and in this case of the study, looking at birds and turtles, birds are more closely related to crocodilians, but those two are most closely related to turtles. So if you look at traits that are common to birds and turtles, one explanation, the simplest explanation, is that they have those common traits because they inherited them from the common ancestor of turtles and birds. Mm-hmm. And because dinosaurs are close to birds are sort of a flying dinosaur, that means that by reconstructing something that is common to the ancestor of turtles and birds, those traits are likely to have been found also in the dinosaurs. So that's the beauty of using a species that exists today to infer what the ancestor might have had, and by inference then be able to say it's a hypothesis that it's likely that those traits were also found in the dinosaurs.
All right. And how hard is this to do? Like, are there, I guess, pitfalls or, like, things you have to look out for? Because while you were talking, I was thinking that both bats and birds have both evolved wings. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, some people might think that they might have a recent common ancestor, but I do not believe they do.
No, that's a good case where you have something that is similar at the surface, sort of the flying, but that has evolved independently in the bats and in the birds, and you can tell the difference when there are traits that have evolved independently versus those that have a common origin, like a homology that we call homologous trait. When you look at these traits in the context of the tree of life and the organisms that share the one trait or the other, and whether their close relatives have those traits or not. And so you will see that birds have that flight, if you look at the structure of the wing, is different from the structure also of the wing of a bat. Mm-hmm. And you see that it sort of shows in just one branch of mammals, which is the bats, and in this other branch of reptiles, that is the bird, the dinosaur and bird.
All right, thank you. So how exactly did you get involved with this study? Because I noticed that most of the other researchers were based in the United Kingdom.
Yes, and this is a group of researchers which was led by Darren Griffin at Kent University in the UK. They've been studying bird evolution and bird genome evolution for quite a while. Now, I've been studying turtle genomes for some time now, and in particular several species, but one of the species that was interesting for this study was the soft-shell turtle, which is the spiny soft-shell turtle that lives here in the U.S. It lives mm-hmm. here at rivers in Iowa. Yeah. And that species, we have looked at the karyotype, the chromosome, so the structure of the genome, how it's organized in chromosomes. In my lab, we discover that this species has ZWX chromosomes, just like birds do. Mm-hmm. And so we've been looking at genomic aspects of the soft shells. We have also looked at embryonic development and the genes that are turned on and off during the development of males and females, and compare that to other turtles, like the painted turtles that also live in Iowa, that have the temperature-dependent sex-determining mechanism. So I have been studying these species for quite a while. And so they contacted me because we had these genomic resources from our lab, given the cytogenetic studies we have done looking at chromosomes. And that was sort of the contribution, is being able to provide the data for the soft-shell turtles to be included in the analysis so mm-hmm. that we could do a turtle-bird comparison.
So how does reconstructing a genome really work? I imagine it's a long, involved process, but could you walk us through it?
So in this case, it's actually relatively simple. It's finding the what the study did. There were two aspects to it. There was a cytogenetics part to it, which is looking at the chromosome themselves, the chromosome structure. So for that, what was done is by taking DNA that belong just to one chromosome pair of the chicken, or pieces of DNA that belong in just one chromosome of chicken, and making a cocktail out of that, and then you paint that with a color, and you take that paint, and you take the chromosomes of a turtle in a microscope slide, and sort of apply that paint and see where that paint goes. If the paint from one chromosome of chicken goes to one chromosome of turtle, then you know that the content of those two is the same, and that those are homologous, what we call homologous chromosomes in the turtle and the bird. If the paint from the chicken goes to two different chromosomes in turtles, then you know that there was some rearrangement. Either in the ancestor there was one single pair that broke apart and became two pairs in the turtle, or there were two pairs in the ancestor that fused together and created one in the bird. Just with two, you wouldn't be able to tell the directionality, whether it was the event one way or the other. But that's one technique that was used. And doing that, it was our study found that there was a lot of homology between chicken chromosomes and the turtle chromosomes, particularly the soft shell turtle chromosomes. There was another turtle that was also used in the study, the slider turtle, but the similarity was more striking was with the soft shell and the chicken. And many of the small, tiny chromosomes that the chicken has appear to have a correspondence one-to-one with just one chicken chromosome to one turtle tiny chromosome as well. And the larger ones were not as some were similar, some were not the same. Some of the small chromosomes were similar, some were not. But a good number of chromosomes were identical at that level, or had a one-to-one correspondence. That means that they have been conserved for a very long time, for over 255 years since the turtles and the birds split from each other. And that's the remarkable part, is to having something that has been conserved for that long. Because usually when you have conservation of a trait for a very long time, it means that it must be, it's likely important biologically for some reason. And we don't know exactly why that structure of the organization of the genome hasn't changed for that long period of time.
Mm-hmm. And how long ago did you say that the birds and the turtles had split?
Around 255 million years, over that approximately, yeah.
All right, thank you. Now we have an idea of what these organisms' genomes might have looked like. Mm-hmm. Is there any way of knowing what the common ancestor of the birds and the turtles, and is there any way of knowing what that might have looked like from the information that you gleaned?
That's harder to do because having the same structure, the birds have it and turtles have it, and most likely those parts that are common, the dinosaurs may have had it, and the ancestor of birds and turtles is most likely to have it. And yet birds look very different to turtles, right? Mm-hmm. So from that information alone, you cannot tell how that ancestor might have looked like. But it is, so you need to go sort of deeper to try to explain the differences between those groups, to explain that diversity in form, in behavior, in coloration. And those differences, which is also part of what the study found, are more likely to be due to changes that happen within the chromosomes. The organization of the DNA content within the chromosomes did change, and doing analysis of the DNA sequences show that there, even if the particular parts of the genome remain in a chromosome, in a package, the information within that chromosome change place, change organization, may have acquired mutations that don't show up when you do the painting, but do show up when you compare the sequences, you align them and compare them. Which was the other aspect that the study did. So it's harder to infer what the ancestor might have looked like, yes, from that, only from that information.
Yeah. So are there any plans to do similar things in other species, like maybe humans or monkeys or fish or sharks? I'm just throwing out examples here, but what are the plans for future genomic reconstruction? Do you have any idea?
So some of those have already been done. There has been studies between human and some other primates, apes and other primates, monkeys, that have been done to try to reconstruct some of those primate ancestral karyotypes. And that has been successful. There has been also comparisons between mammals and birds, trying to reconstruct the reptilian mammal bird ancestor, the amniote ancestor karyotype. And it has been done in plants also. So some of these efforts have been successful already. But it will continue. Like my lab is now, has been working for a while to try to reconstruct the ancestral turtle karyotype. Because turtles vary so much in chromosome number from only 28 to 68, there has been, it's obvious that there has been rearrangements, at large scale rearrangements, and we want to understand why. And in particular, because those changes in chromosome number in turtles are associated with changes in the sex determining system from the temperature dependent one to the XY chromosomes or CW chromosomes. So, and we don't understand right now why. So we are doing we're still working on a project to try to do that. So we have plans to do that. We are working on cytogenetic studies to do that reconstruction. And we're also doing genome sequencing of various turtles to try to look at the DNA content as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Marie. That was Nicole Valenzuela from the Laboratory of Evolutionary and Ecological Genomics at Iowa State University. If you're just tuning in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I am one of your hosts, Josh Oren, along with Paul Wirfson. So Paul had a moment to talk with Kay Berger, a licensed therapist who has written a book about a woman she met many years ago who, among many mental diagnoses, also had multiple personalities, about 110 that I last heard. So, yeah, take it away, Paul.
Well, on Local Talk today, we have a special guest. My guest in the studio is Kay Berger, who is a social worker, master's degree in social work, and she's written a book called I, We, or Whoever, with 110 Lives, not counting the first one. It's about a woman who has multiple personality issues. And Kay, take us from the top. Now, you're a licensed therapist, and you encountered this woman when?
About 1991. She was referred by the psychiatrist for therapy. She had all different kinds of diagnoses. She's been through a lot of mental health.
But she was referred to you, I believe, because she had abused her child.
Yes.
And
yes.
So that's how she came to your attention.
Yeah.
And her name was...
Actually, all of the names in the book are not are secured. They're not... They're made up.
Okay. But this woman
so her
was,
name in the book is Mariah.
Mariah. Okay. And she came into your office as a 36-year-old woman referred because obviously she has psychiatric issues.
Yes.
And tell us the story of what happened in your discovery of what was really going on with Mariah.
Okay. I will call her Mariah. 23 years of my career was spent in treating her. When she first walked into my office, I thought it was a 36-year-old. And within a year or a year and a half, I knew that I was talking to a 7-year-old named Sarah. The only way I knew that was after she had given me some information, was that she walked into my office and I said, well, hello, Mariah. And she says, I'm not Mariah, I'm Sarah. And that was my first clue that we were probably talking about a dissociative identity disordered patient.
So she revealed herself as a child, really. Sarah is how old?
7.
So what's the mechanics of this? Obviously, Mariah was seriously wounded emotionally at the very tender age.
Well, at 18 months old, and I learned this through therapy with her, at 18 months old, she withdrew into her mind, and that's where she stayed. And she had a whole community in her mind, but it started out with her in Jonathan's hands. He was a giant. And remember that she just withdrew. So she was a 36-year-old body, but she had other lives that lived separately from her. And her body performed everything that she went through. Now, I'll give you an instance. What happened was she withdrew into her mind, and she was replaced by an alter named April, who could tolerate the pain that she was feeling. Her mother was a horrible, horrible abuser, both sexual and physical. And so that's April took over. When April could not tolerate the pain, another alter took over, named Angel. And Angel could do it without speaking. Again, remember, these are separate alters, so that when I talked to them, I was talking to a little child. I was a 36-year-old body and a child.
Now, when you use the word alter, that refers to each personality.
That's right. That's the personality. Mm-hmm. It was to find out about all of these alters. It was kind of like dumping 110 picture.
It's a community of people.
That's right. It was like dumping them on the floor and picking them up one at a time. That's what it was like.
And
a
so
puzzle.
You went through laborious therapy with her.
Oh, yes.
Now, she's a woman who's married with children. Is that correct?
Well, one of her alters was. Constance was married, and she was married to a real person. There's alters in there, how she met, and so forth, yes. And then she had 2 children, and they adopted a child. But Constance was the kind mother, but she had an alter that was the personification of her mother. And the mother would warn her inside. She had the whole community inside that lived there. And the mother would, named the boss, would warn her, don't talk, don't tell. And there was all kinds of communication to her, to whatever, whoever I was talking to.
Now,
don't
talk. This was a barrier to her abuse of her actual children, then?
Well, it was, yeah. It was a barrier to protect her. Everybody was protecting her so that she could get through life. She was, everything inside of her brain, her mind was in protection of her as she went through. And of course, this got in the way of her living her life as an adult, because all she had were these alters. She had no persona of her own. So when she abused her child, it was because that's all she knew how to do when her child misbehaved.
So in the real world, she was able to function And she had these devices internally that kept her at somewhat on an even keel day to day.
Well, yes. And, they had to. She, again, was in a survival mode all the time. In order to survive through her child, she had to go into the mental health system. So there was somebody to take a hold then, a separate one, to get her through. She was a drinker. She was a heavy, heavy drinker. So in order to get through the original life, she had three drinkers that would go out and drink in order to cover up some of the things that were going on.
Well, this is immensely complicated. Now, you were able
to. Immensely.
So that's what required so many years of therapy.
Yes.
Now, you've documented the existence of each of these 110 people. And they all had different functions in self-protection.
Sarah was the one who would write a lot of this. And some of the alters would write also, and that's in the book. But I have about 300 pages of written by Sarah and by others in the book. Now, to make things much more complicated, Trooper was her guide. And Trooper lived up in her memory, but he knew everything. But he wanted all of these alters to tell their story and get their therapy, which I gave them.
So you were giving therapy to each of these alters?
To each of them, yes. One, I never knew who was coming in. One time, the 13-year-old, Amelia Ann, came in. She happened to be the one that turned her dad in for sexual abuse. There was a great deal of sexual abuse by her dad. And she turned him in, to the authorities. And so he went to jail, and she felt awful about this, just awful, having to do this. And there was another called Devil's Child, who her dad, her personification of her dad in the community had thrown her in the junkyard. And that's where this alter lived. And we pulled her out by going into the community, working with those in the community to get her out of the junkyard and into the care of Lillian.
This required a great deal of imagination on your part. You
had
to
yes.
get into this world.
Oh, yes.
Now, there was some involvement with a satanic cult. Is
yes,
that correct?
That's right. When she was five, her dad became involved in a satanic cult that believes in the satanic issues. They are sort of Satan is God, and he is good, and God is bad.
Now, they perpetrated some perpetrated on people that they dealt with. They were abusive
right.
to people themselves, right?
Well, they were, yes. And so he got the five-year-old involved in the cult in order to become important in this cult. Her real dad did. That was really the hardest, one of the hardest, because they are so cruel. They impregnate alters that are, they impregnate the people that come into there, and then they kill the babies and they eat them and they do all kinds of awful things. And so that was really hard for me to get through.
So this person, over the years, how many years are we talking about here, Kate?
We're talking 6 years to find out who all the alters were. And then she came back once we found out, and I'd talked to about 40 of the alters, and they came back. She came back, and she then... Somebody else had lived her life, and she walked into my office and she said, "Well, I think I know you, and I think I know the doctor, but I don't know who I am. And will you help me?" And so then we had to go through 6 more years of all the alters telling her what awful, awful things she'd done.
Well, now, at the end of this period, what's the product? What is what's happening at the end, or when you felt that a lot of therapy had had the impact it was going to have? What was the product?
Well, at the end, we were trying to find, we were trying to integrate all of these into memory so that they would not come in and out all the time. And because it was, you know, they're living in the past and she's living in the present, and it doesn't work out too well. The idea was for her to integrate, for me to help her integrate. But when we got to the end, the personalities or the alters were afraid they'd disappear and not be able to protect her anymore.
They would defend themselves.
Yeah. Well, So I had to talk to the alters and tell them they would not disappear. They would go into her memory, but they wouldn't be able to come out anymore. And they agreed that it was a lot of trust in me.
So at the end of this thing, you're talking about a woman who is much better equipped to deal with daily life and cope.
Yes.
Did what happened with her problems with alcohol, did that diminish?
She went into AA, yes. She suffered all of her life through addiction, and or lives through addiction, and then her life afterwards, she was addicts or addicted, no matter who, how they drink. And so she went into AA and was sober the last, about 5 years.
And she's passed away at this point?
Yes, she
has. But looking back, you feel good about your interaction with her,
yes,
her progress,
uh-huh,
and that you had helped her as much as you could.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Now, the other thing about this is, and I'm reminding everybody, that this is a book by Kay Berger. It's called I, We, or Whoever, One Woman with 110 Lives, Not Counting the First One. Now, you self-published this book, and I wanted to know how you went about doing that.
Well, I went on the Internet, and I looked at publishers, and finally, I saw Hoist Printing here. Right up the hill from where I live. And so I started talking to them, and they said, it looks like we can publish this book for you. And they helped me put the whole thing together.
And they helped you with editing and all of this?
Everything. And pictures. There's some pictures in there. I want to make clear, too, that this is a therapy book. It runs her through therapy. It isn't the story of a multiple per se. It is a therapeutic journey through what a therapist does with a patient. And that's how she wanted it. She turned everything over to me.
Well, now, this book is available. And without mentioning cost, how does one find a copy of this book?
Well, here's, you can get it on the Internet.
Good.
It has a long Internet.
Okay.
But you can go to hoiss.com, H-E-U-S-S.com, or you can email adam@hoiss.
Okay, and Hoiss is spelled H-E-U-S-S.
Yes.
That's the way to get a line on this book. And it's fascinating. The book title is I, We, or Whoever, One Woman with 110 Lives, Not Counting the First One. And Kay Berger, who did the therapy over a period of how many years, Kay?
Well, I was with her. We got through kind of through the therapy in 12 years, but I stayed with her then to try and pull her through life for 23 years.
Well, Kay Berger, glad to have you as a guest. And I'll tell you what, that's fascinating. 110 people living within the person here. And you helped her to mitigate that over a number of years. The book is I, We, or Whoever, One Woman with 110 Lives, Not Counting the First One. Thank you, Kay Berger.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, Paul. If you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Our final guest in the studio today is Casey Johnson of Ames Ford Lincoln, and he's here to talk about a program called Wheels for Work. Did I get that right?
You sure did.
All right. Yeah. Welcome to the studio, Casey.
Well, thank you for the invite. I appreciate it.
Well, so just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm your local car dealer here in town, but I'm from Fort Dodge, and we've been up there 22 years, and we're always been involved in the community. I have a wife that volunteers a lot and two sons that I get to work with every day. So that that makes life enjoyable. And we've been very blessed, so we try to get involved in a lot of community efforts.
So talking about community efforts, what is Wheels for Work?
Well, at our dealerships up in Fort Dodge about 20 years ago, we saw a need for single mothers that are trying to put ends together. They're working hard. They're trying to raise a family. They had a domestic issue through domestic violence or drugs or whatever it may be. And they fell on hard times, but trying to hold down a job. So they're either taking a city bus or a cab or walking to work. And we said, that's just not right. So we came up with this program called Wheels for Work. And we partnered with United Way, and it's been hugely successful.
So one reason this story was really interesting to me is because I work at Access here in Ames, mm-hmm. the domestic violence shelter. And I have seen how that kind of struggle with a single mother with kids
sure.
who just got out of a domestic violence situation, how hard that is for them, especially when you know, they depended a lot on the father figure, and then they turned out to be abusive, and then they have to cut that off, and then they have to start from square one.
And it's very, very unfair to the single mom.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, no fault of hers, and she tries to keep the family together. And so when an abusive husband leaves the relationship, guess what he takes with him? He takes the car.
Right. Yeah.
And anything else he can grab. So it just breaks your heart to see these moms struggle, and so we are nearing 100 cars that we put on the street in Webster County and in Story County. So when we moved down here in 2012 and bought the dealership, I immediately contacted United Way and Gene and the staff over there and said, hey, I got an entire turnkey program. It's been very successful up in Webster County. I'd like to bring it to Story County. And the United Way staff was open arms about it because there's a lot of application and background checking and process that we go through, and they were very helpful. So it was a great partnership.
So you really I'm Paul here.
Hi, Paul.
Interrupting this. But you go through a system where you assert the need, and you know that person is needy, and there's really a prevailing need for transportation. I want to give another perspective on this. My career was manager of job service or the mm-hmm. employment office in Des Moines. And we had all this development of hotels and restaurants out in West Des Moines. You know how that is. It's just a great industry that's really hospitality. And the sorts of people who need those kinds of jobs lived on the east side of Des Moines or the inner mm-hmm. city. The transit system in Des Moines was limited in the hours they ran and how far. And so a lot of the people who needed those jobs, and of course, conversely, those employers needed them. But
right.
transportation was a huge issue. And it was so yeah. frustrating. They didn't have private transportation. If here in central Iowa, how can you live without a car? So that is really an identifiable need. Just for having an opportunity to work, and not only that, but the kids to the doctor, all the things we
sure.
use a car for. You
know. Well, and it's a natural. You know, I'm in the car business, and this was something that there's a lot of insurance and title application and paperwork involved, and we take care of everything for the moms. And you're right, Paul. You know, you talk to things after we give the recipient a car and we go through this extensive application process through United Way, and we see that this is definitely a qualified single mom that really needs help. After a few days with their car, they usually call us. In this case, when we handed her the keys, said, well, what's going on today? And she says, we're going to the grocery store. This will be the first time as a family we're going to go to the grocery store together. And they would take a bus, and she would carry the groceries home. A neighbor would watch the kids. But it was a big deal for her to go to a grocery store and have her kids walk down the aisle with them. And this can affect the entire family because it puts stress on grandparents or parents, brothers and sisters to try to help out the single mom in need. And so it really fills a gap. And great point. Some of these kids want to play in band. They want to do sports. They have medical issues. They need transportation. Just plain and simple.
When you talk about all their siblings and family members who might have to step in and help this single parent, when she doesn't have to ask for that help anymore, that gives her dignity, confidence, sure. independence.
Yep. And, you know, they're really back on to being self-sufficient and getting their feet back on the ground. And we've heard great success stories. And one lady ended up remarrying and has a wonderful life, getting advancements in jobs. The kids, the biggest plus, because to not offer your child that 7 a.m. band practice because they just can't get them to school is heartbreaking. We had one mother that their child had a rare skin disorder and had to go to Iowa City to the hospital every other week. We got a van for her, and she's covered, but each week it was a challenge how she thought she was going to get transportation to get over to Iowa City. And that day we gave her the car, the next day she was off to Iowa City. So, and one of my favorite stories, and I'm going to keep it together this time. This
almost,
mom called.
It almost makes you tear up.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. She called and said, hey, you know, how are things going? And I just want to let you know we just love our car. And she said, we went out for ice cream last night. And I said, well, that's pretty exciting. She said, well, you don't understand. We used to go to ice cream in a cab. And when her kids got out of the cab, the other kids laughed at them. And she said, it's something as simple as going to get ice cream.
You hit on something very important, and that is the peer relationships of the children. Mm-hmm. Other kids really see things that are different from their own background. And most middle-class kids are chauffeured everywhere. And if they see a peer who doesn't have that basic thing, it's tempting to judge them and punish them in some way or make fun of them.
Right.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because these kids need to be perceived as normal by their peers, you know. And the car is central to that, surprising, you know.
And, you know, heck, we all take a car for granted, you know, and that's just
right, exactly.
Something we hop in and turn the key and away we go. But for these moms, it's really, really a tough thing, and it's great independence for them.
But this is a marvelous thing because I always like to see people in the private sector do things that are community-oriented and a valuable social service. And
well, yeah, we look at it as a helping hand, not a handout, because these moms are doing the work. And we're just rewarding them for their efforts of keeping their family life and family together as much as possible. So they
how long have you been doing this now?
Well, we're probably approaching
Fort Dodge,
15 years back in Webster County in Fort Dodge, and for the last 5 years here in Ames. And again, United Way staff has been great to work with and help us out with the application. So people always wonder, and I know you asked me, Josh, how do people donate cars?
Yeah.
Or is there a process to it?
Yeah, I had been wondering, how can people, you know, listening, help donate to this process?
You know, we take a lot of our own vehicles and repair them and fix them up and clean them up and do safety checks and everything. But our appeal is also to the general public to donate a car to this program. So you can call the dealership at Ames Ford and ask for myself, Casey, or my son, Nick. And we accept the donated car there. We give you a tax form that is receipted through the United Way of Story County. And then you can take that form and that receipt from United Way and have a tax-deductible donation with your car. And from that point, we do the safety check and run it through the whole process. And then we contact United Way and say, okay, who's our next lucky recipient? We have a car ready. And you know, hopefully this will spur some thought out there. Someone, their kids are off to college or moved away. They got that second or third car just kind of sitting there, not being used a whole lot. This would make a tremendous impact in Story County. And then, heck, you don't have to pay that insurance and extra license, all that kind of stuff.
And, you know, you have the feeling that you're doing something for somebody in releasing that car for this program. That's boy, it's win, 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 mm-hmm. win.
And I've had people call and say, hey, where'd my car go? And, you know, we sent them the updates and stuff. And the people that donated the van and the mother's taking her child to Iowa City with a rare skin disorder, they are just overwhelmed with joy. And rather than, you know, sometimes writing a check, which is always great and needed in many cases, this they really felt a connection and had an impact on that young family.
And we've talked about the many facets of that impact, from peer relationships with children to the convenience of little things we take for granted, like going out for groceries, to very important things like the ability to go out of town to medical appointments if your son or daughter has some sort of chronic medical condition. So yeah. It just makes life bearable, and opportunities spring up once you have your own transportation.
Yeah, and we've learned a lot over the years with this program. And, you know, we hand them the car, we hand them the title, we hand them the keys, and guess what sometimes reappears in the picture is that abusive husband.
Is that right?
And grabs the title, grabs the car, and that really gets my hair turning on the back of my neck. And so now we hold on to the title for the single mom. After she keeps her job and keeps working and improving her life, we just give her the title after the year, but mainly for the protection of an abusive husband figure in the area. And so it's really, you know, we really fine-tuned it. It's working great. They can be out there on the streets and have a bad tire or something. You know, they just give us a call and we do some additional light maintenance. We just want to keep them sufficient, moving, productive, and a happy family life. That's what it's all about.
Well, you know, Casey, I didn't see that coming, the abusive husband returning, because oh, yeah. they're probably in a situation where their vehicle is deteriorated or something, yeah. and they want to come back and get that, and they expect free license to do that. So
we didn't expect that, and kind of caught us off guard. And, you know, so we just modify the program, and it's just it's a beautiful thing.
Well, Casey Johnson, Josh, what do you think?
Well, I think it's great that you're doing this. So I know personally, I just want to thank you for doing this. Yeah, just a car, you know, it gives that single mom more power in that situation. Even just if it's a little bit, having a car, to use a dreadful pun, it goes miles in their personal life. So
that's beautiful.
I like
Josh.
That. Yes. I mean,
let's carve that in stone somewhere.
Yeah. All right, you can do that. Yeah. So we have been speaking with Casey Johnson of Ames Ford Lincoln. So again, thanks for coming in, Casey.
I sincerely appreciate the invite. Thank you.
This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I am Josh Oren, hosting with Paul Wearson. Thank you for listening.
Well, earlier in the show today, we heard Nicole Valenzuela on dinosaur genomics and the relation to turtles and birds. And then we sat with Kay Berger on her book, I, We, or Whoever, One Woman with 110 Lives, not counting the first one. Then we talked with Casey Johnson on this program, on the program of Wheels for Work, which helps single moms with transportation while raising a family and working on their own. Today's show is engineered by Jackie Norman. Mm-hmm.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can listen to the show online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI streams live online at, yet again, khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team.
Stay tuned for headline news and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is sponsored in part by Ames Electric Services, providing the option for any electric customer to support solar energy by investing in SunSmart Ames, a community solar farm. Learn more how you can make your energy greener at www.cityofames.org/solar.